Well, listen to 2 John 12. Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face so that our joy may be complete. I had read that dozens of times before I really got into media ecology. And then it suddenly dawned on me when I was reading it, wow, this has a serious point about media ecology, even with the simplest of technologies, paper and ink. And it made me realize that now a kind of ironic twist has occurred where if you send somebody a note this is a hobby of mine, is collecting pens, fountain pens, and nice stationery. Cranes is a great source of good stationery, and there are a number of others. But you write a personal note, and I do my Christmas cards that way, so they're always addressed with my fountain pen. And that's a new, people think, wow, you know, that's personal. No one ever gets one like that because it's all handwritten and the cards are handmade as well. But just handwriting a note is now an extremely personal thing. And you'll notice sometimes there are clever advertising pieces that come in the mail that they use a font that looks like it's handwritten, but of course it's not handwritten. But in any case, it's a wonderful way. I recommend that to people. I write a handwritten note, and thank you notes, of course, are still appropriate. And so those can be important. But here, what he's saying, of course, is that nothing replaces face-to-face connection. And so what we see now is a world which is more and more moving away from that. Even the board meetings at GCP, it was suggested recently that we actually do one of the two board meetings that we do annually via gotomeeting.com. And as you might expect, I have quietly said, I don't really think this is a good idea because we're going to miss something. I remember I had an argument with my son. Well, it was the discussion, but it got a little heated. And he said, Dad, you know, you're just exaggerating this face-to-face thing. You know, courses, online courses, they're cheaper, they're whatever. And he had a whole list of rationale. And he said, and what is the difference anyway? And I said, you know, the difference is so profound and mysterious that you can't actually, I can say some things about it, but it's so profound and mysterious that you simply have to experience the difference between the two. And there are things we can say about face-to-face, and we're going to say a lot of them actually in this hour. But when I remember in December of 06, 12 million people were on Facebook, and I thought, wow, that's a lot of people on Facebook. It's nothing. So February 2018, 2.13 billion monthly active Facebook users, 1.15 billion mobile daily active users, and then 1.4 billion daily active users of Facebook itself. There are actually only 67 million Twitter users. But think about that. That's a sizable portion of the population of the United States. And that population, of course, includes infants and little children. So that's pretty significant. But 2.13 billion. We're talking about some serious numbers there that are now, we're starting to see some of the fallout from that. We're seeing all kinds of alarms being raised. This book is one that I do highly recommend, especially for anyone who is dealing with this new generation. It's called iGen by Gene Twing, or Twenge, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. Why today's super-connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood. So it's interesting in my review that I do on OS. I think I did it last month or the month before. One of the things I conclude is that most of the Christian young people that I know in this new generation, born between 95 and 2012, the alarms don't go off with me as a pastor the way they are for her, just as a sociologist dealing with a general population. So that's good news for the Christian church. We actually stand out as being different because we actually promote face-to-face connections. We promote living in the real world. We promote the idea of understanding that people are going to disagree with you, and we learn how to intelligently and civilly and prayerfully deal with those realities. So we have a personal responsibility. I think I mentioned this actually in the last lecture in terms of our pedagogical responsibility in the church. And so we could call this personal slash pedagogical, meaning leadership. Everyone needs to take note of this. We say, well, we can't do anything about this. It's just a pervasive reality. And the National Endowment for the Arts, back when it was under the leadership of Dana Gioia in 2004, Dana Gioia, by the way, is a really wonderful conservative Catholic poet, and gave great leadership to the National Endowment for the Arts. But Reading at Risk was the report that he would give annually. I guess he as the president had to give a report, or chairman, and this was his report. Reading at Risk. Okay, so there's the death of the book. And the death of the book isn't so important as the death of reading. And so he was gravely concerned about this. 2007, to read or not to read, it not only sounded the alarm, but it actually gave educators particularly things that they could do to change this. And so I remember I had a son, my youngest son said years ago that he would never, you know, he's in a house with thousands of books everywhere. And that could annoy kids, maybe. So he was active. He wanted to be outside and do stuff. And he said, I will never read a book except a computer manual. I don't know how he ever came up with that one, but he liked computers. So one day I found a second copy of The Rise of the Third Reich. And this is a doorstop of a book by Shearer, I think it was. It's a mid-20th century book. And I gave it to him. I said, Chris, maybe you'd like to read this. I know you say you're not going to read anything but computer manuals, but try this. So over the next month, when I'd go upstairs and I'd see in his room, this book was lying next to the bed, and it was opened, and he was moving through the pages of this 700-page tome because it was exciting. The Third Reich, you know, it was very interesting, and it captured his attention. And so We have to show young people the value of reading, and this is what Dana Gioia realized. And so in this report, he really challenged people, educators in particular, and parents to do something about it, because there had been a 20% decline in the youngest age group surveyed in 2002 between 18 and 24. And by 2008, so 6 years later, the percentage was completely reversed, 21% increase in reading. And then in 2009, his report was Reading on the Rise. Now, in this book, you get an interesting thing. She says, it looks like there's more reading going on, but what's really not going on is recreational reading. So in other words, the kids will do what they have to do for school, but not recreational reading. Not explorational reading and literary reading in particular. And I don't know. It's hard to judge. But the point is that I think there was something serious happening there. And educators, everyone has a responsibility to do something about the problem of a lack of reading. And the church is the best place for it. I mean, the young people that I know, are by and large, there's a lot of reading going on, a lot of good reading, and it's because parents and pastors encourage that activity. So, as Marshall McLuhan would say, don't be an idiot. What does that mean? Sounds nasty, doesn't it? Sounds like he was being uncivil, but he wasn't, because he was classically educated, and here's what he said. He said, our conventional response to all media, namely that it is how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot. In another place, he called them somnambulists. So they're sleepwalking through life. And what you realize that he's going by the New Testament idea of idiotes. That's actually a Greek word. And it simply means an outsider. And so if you are a Greek or an idiot, a barbarian, it doesn't mean you're unintelligent. It just means that you don't know Greek. You're an outsider, in other words, to the language. And McLuhan is saying, if we don't understand how the electronic media is affecting us, it's because we're an outsider to its language. And that's what the technological idiot is. And so by understanding that, we can promote face-to-face, and we can promote better habits in the midst of an electronic environment that has also wonderful benefits, but they've got to be harnessed by discipline and wise navigation. And so we look at the famous quote by Oscar Wilde, who said something about temptation. Did you realize that Oscar Wilde had something to say about temptation? When asked what to do when you're faced with temptation, he said, give in to it. And that's often, I mean, that's ridiculous, obviously, and as Christians, we certainly take the opposite stance about sanctification and holiness, that we have to do something about it, but sometimes we take cultural influences, unless they're obvious ethical influences, we take them, and especially technological influences, we don't think about them, and that's what we need to do. So remember the statement of Morse, his enthusiastic declaration, what has God wrought, with an exclamation point after it. We turn it into a question as Christians and ask, what has he wrought and what can we do about it? And so as we looked at the tendency to disincarnation, and I said I was going to say something more about Sherry Turkle, who wrote the famous book, 2011, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other. So the subtitle is really, I think, rather profound. And she is the Abby Rockefeller Mousey Professor of Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. Nice, simple title. And she's the founder and director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. And she's also a licensed clinical psychologist. And so here's a quote from after she wrote Alone Together, or maybe it's actually from that book. She says, I reported on this work, that is the focus groups on boundaries between real and virtual worlds, okay, that was her research, in my 1995 Life on the Screen, which offered on balance a positive view of new opportunities for exploring identity online. But by then, my optimism of 1984, that was her first book, which was called The Second Self, had been challenged because now I was meeting people, many people, who found online life more satisfying than what some derisively call RL, real life. And so is it a surprise that we have kids on the college campuses shouting down controversial speakers and wanting safe spaces, wanting to be coddled as if they were infants just out of the womb? It shouldn't be a surprise because this is what is happening. And just think about that. Real life is hard. It's also wonderful. It's both and everything in between. And so what VR offers is a dangerous escape. Now, like anything, I know I surely, after the end of a long day, enjoy escaping into a good movie or a good book. And there's nothing wrong with that in its place. But we have a whole generation now that is finding virtual reality because it's something you can control and it helps you escape all of real life. That's a really dangerous, dangerous trend. And so we think about social media and particularly smartphones, and the social media, of course, are connected to by smartphones now, for the most part. And so what are some of the dangers for us to watch out for? Tony Reinke, who is a very thoughtful Christian, my friend T. David Gordon has recently reviewed this, an ordained servant, I think it's the last month or the month before. He wrote a book called 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You. It's really a profound book, and he is a student of McLuhan, a student of Postman, a student of Ellul, a student of the media ecology group, and there are some warnings that we have. Now, I had come up with these warnings before I read his book, but I just mention him as someone that I think has very astutely critiqued the smartphone. He's critiqued the smartphone as one who was an addictive user early in his career and was deeply involved in electronics and all of that, that whole world. And so here are some warnings. The tendency towards deception. Now, remember one of the things we said about postmodernism, which likes to deconstruct everything, institutions, ideas, everything, is also deconstructing gender. It's a great example of that kind of deconstruction and the damage, the tremendous damage that it can do. Ken Myers actually spoke here 12 years ago, and he was speaking about these issues of technology and our humanity. And I remember Andy Sharp asked him the question, well, do you think that we can actually change human nature? And I'll never forget his answer. He said, no, but we can do a lot of damage trying. And that's what we see happening. Now, instead of changing human nature online, what's happening in social media is constructing a false self. And one of the things that Twenge reports on is the fact that there's much greater depression, alarming amounts of depression going on in this newest generation. But online, everything's wonderful. And especially me, I'm wonderful, and I want to get as many thumbs up, as many friends and likes that I can get. And so what this does is creates hypocrisy. And you know, hypocrisy, that word actually comes from the theater in the ancient world, where it's a mask, you know, frowning or smiling. And so there's a mask here that's going on that is very dangerous. And Proverbs says, better is a poor person who walks in his integrity than one who is crooked in speech and is a fool. And so social media has given us the potential of creating false selves, and that is actually a form of lying. It also breeds covetousness because we only tell the good things that are happening. And I have a friend that went online on Facebook. I have never been on Facebook, but I've talked to many people that have, just to kind of stay abreast of things. And he decided he would go online and join Facebook for a time. And he connected with some friends, and he said, Greg, and this is a mature Christian minister, he said, it made me covetous. He said, I had to really work on covetousness because of the profiles that people present. You know, then you want to keep up with what others are doing, and that tempts you not only to be covetous, but to lie. And so it's something that is a danger. The second thing would be the tendency towards sinful communication, because false communication is sinful. But sinful communication is those things that we would say on Facebook that we would never say face-to-face. And I have friends that have told me about the reactions after the election. And if you voted for a certain candidate that surprisingly won, you could be vilified. And I'm not going to let you know my political leanings here, but that's just an example of what can happen. It can happen the other way around as well, depending on your party. And it made me think of the proverb, a gentle tongue is a tree of life, but perverseness in it breaks the spirit. So that's the tendency, is to use the tongue for perverse means. And I think that social media just offers a platform that makes that easier to do. Again, remember, there are many good things that can happen there. I'm not on it, so I haven't experienced them, but I'm not demeaning it, only giving you these warnings. And beware the tendency to undermine accountability. It's interesting, before Paul in Ephesians talks about husbands and wives and slaves and masters, he says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And so we have a mutual accountability that unless we're actively involved in lots of healthy face-to-face relationships, the social media can distance us from that and we stop being accountable. Of course, just being online can be sort of like being in the big city with no accountability to anybody. It can be a dangerous place to be.